Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Vermeulener. Missouri's legislative session came to a close on Friday. It marked the conclusion of a period that saw a number of accomplishments and upsets, particularly for Governor Jay Nixon, who this year faced veto-proof majorities in both the House and Senate. Throughout the session, lawmakers deliberated on expanding the state's Medicaid program, tax credit reform, and gun control. One of the more surprising developments this year was the discovery that state agencies had released the names of over 160,000 concealed weapon permit holders to federal investigators. The uproar that ensued resulted in hearings and calls for investigations, the resignation of the head of the Department of Revenue, and reduced funding for the Department of Motor Vehicles. On today's Intersection, we'll take a look back at the year and hear from some lawmakers about what was and wasn't accomplished. Joining me in studio today, Chris Kelly is Democratic State Representative for the part of northeastern Boone County. Representative Kelly, thanks for joining the show.
Glad to be here.
And Caleb Browden is a Republican and the state representative for the other part of northeastern Boone County and the part of southeastern Randolph County. He's just finished his first legislative session. Welcome to the show, Representative Browden.
Thanks, sir.
And Kurt Schaefer is a Republican state senator representing Boone and Cooper counties. He's also the chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee. Thanks for being here, Senator Schaefer.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. And for you and our audience, were you following this year's legislative session? What surprised you? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia or join our online chat. So to start off, we're going to likely spend a good part of today's show talking about some things that didn't happen this legislative session. But in the governor's press conference after the session ended on Friday, Governor Jay Nixon expressed his disappointment specifically about his failed attempt to expand Medicaid. And we wanted to play a quick clip from that press conference.
Hundreds of thousands of working Missourians will needlessly go without health coverage. And the dollars that Missouri taxpayers send to Washington will be spent in other states instead. All this important unfinished business is particularly stark in the light of unnecessary things the legislature did find time to address, like Sharia law and something called Agenda 21.
Okay, so we're definitely going to get to that statement there, things like that later in the show. But sure. For now, we wanted to start somewhere else with the show, with a slightly different approach. I want to hear from each of you about something that did happen this session, something that each of you are proud of. So, Chris Kelly, why don't we start with you?
Two good things. One was significantly increased funding for the higher education in the University of Missouri, specifically some funding for an expansion of the med school for third and fourth year students to be in southwest Missouri. The person primarily responsible for that happening was Kurt Schaefer. It was a wonderful – we all helped, but that was Kurt's baby. He did a great job on it. Another thing that was significant in the legislature this year was the bill that we passed regarding some increases in the legislation, improvements in the legislation regarding rape and domestic violence. Some real serious improvements that I was very glad to sponsor in the House.
Can you talk a little bit about what the specifics are on that?
Well, as to the rape stuff, to make it clear that it is rape to rape somebody who is incapacitated, even if you don't cause the incapacitation.
Okay. All right. Senator Schaefer, on to you. What are you proud of from this session?
Well, I'd echo what Chris said. The vagary in the law as far as sexual assault when somebody's incapacitated was a problem in Missouri law. We worked with the prosecutors. We were very glad to get that fixed. You know, as chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, the budget is one of my biggest issues. $66 million increase for higher ed. Almost half that goes to the University of Missouri system, and most of that goes right here to the campus in Columbia. On top of that, we were able to increase funding for K-12 education by $28 million, which is the highest funding ever for the K-12 budget. And on top of that, some things specifically for this district, and as Chris mentioned, We were able to put in a new $10 million program for the med school here at Mizzou, which would be an ongoing program, and it's a partnership between Columbia and Springfield. It basically expands the med school by 34 slots. And really the issue that you get into with med schools now is you've got more capacity at med schools than you've got for residency programs at hospitals. And so this is a partnership with both Cox and Mercy Hospitals, which are the two hospitals in Springfield, to provide residency positions for those 34 slots. And Weldon Webb and Kathleen Quinn, who work with the university, with the med school, really did a fantastic job with this program. They do a lot of work trying to get Missouri students to go into the medical field and then stay in Missouri and practice. And so this is a great attempt, and I think it'll be very successful at getting more healthcare providers on the ground, especially in Southwest Missouri, where there's a lack of them.
And back to that education funding, the increase compared to previous years, where it hasn't been as easy to get that done. What was different this year? How was
well,
that
the
possible?
Last 4 years in a row, the General Assembly has increased higher ed funding more than the governor would let out the door. He'd overwithhold, and that's actually the subject of the lawsuit between the auditor and the governor, which is currently pending in the Missouri Supreme Court, of whether or not when we have the money, the governor has the ability to hold back the money the General Assembly appropriates, and we'll see what the Supreme Court says about that. But this is one year that I've been there, and it's my fifth session, that we actually had agreement with the governor to increase higher ed funding, and the governor agreed that if we put that in there, he'd let it go out the door. And so I was very glad to have that agreement with the governor, and I know that higher ed could use it because as we've been expanding other portions of the budget, particularly Medicaid and others, and I'm sure we'll talk about that, you know, the loser in that discussion is both K-12 and higher ed because that's where the discretionary general revenue comes from to pay for increases in those other programs. And so I'm glad that we could finally, for the first year in a long time, pick up some of that education funding and step it up a little bit to where it should be.
Okay. And then Caleb Brown, it's been a while since I asked the question, but what happened this session that you were proud of?
Well, I think, you know, one of the big things that we were celebrating in the House that made it to the governor's desk was the first income tax reform in 100 years or so in the state of Missouri, an income tax cut that will take the personal income tax rate from 6% to 5.5% over the course of 10 years, I think, and then it'll cut corporate income tax in half over that same period. There's triggers built in there that will make it to where there has to be a certain amount of revenue growth the year prior for the cut the next year to come to fruition. So I think it's a good measured response to some of the stuff that's going on around us. And I think I hope it's something that the governor will sign. I hope it's something that will allow for an infusion of new dollars in the private sector. And hopefully just continue to allow the economy in Missouri to grow. It was a good year for revenues in the state legislature, and hopefully we can continue to see that trend move upward.
And you kind of got to the main question there is, will the governor sign that? I guess I wonder what Senator Schaefer or Representative Kelly, what you think of that?
On the tax cut legislation?
Yes.
I think he's already sent some pretty strong signals that he will not sign that.
Right. So, I don't know.
I think he will veto it, and I think he should veto it. It is very, very bad public policy. The net effect will be that it will take money out of education and transfer it to only, almost exclusively, to incredibly wealthy people who are the people for whom we did it. But there's no question that it's a transfer from elementary and secondary and higher education into the pockets of very wealthy supporters of the legislation.
Okay. Any response to that from either of you?
No, I mean, I don't quite agree with Chris on that. But, you know, just like the tax credit reform legislation that we looked at, which was very vaguely could be considered tax credit reform, there was a cutback in low-income housing and historic preservation, but there was creation of a new sports authority tax credit, land assemblage tax credit, new market tax credit, a lot of expansion. And some of those things benefit some people. Some of them are to the detriment of other people. Usually on those programs, small number of people that benefit from those. And that's the kind of thing that I'm glad, frankly, that we weren't able to get through because I think from public policy perspective, looking at how we create ways for more funding for public education and other things is a much better broad-spectrum public policy issue than some of these tax credit proposals we've seen.
Yeah, and tax credit reform has been something that's been discussed for a number of years now in the legislature. So what is holding it up? Why can't it happen so far? What can make it happen?
Well, you know, you've got, for example, City of St. Louis has been the largest recipient of the Historic Preservation Tax Credit, but Columbia has as well. The Tiger Hotel, the Arts District here over on Walnut, those all would not exist but for those tax credits. And so you have some parts of the state that benefit from those tax credits, some that don't. And so those that don't want to see implementation of other tax credits or other programs, and those parts of the state that benefit from existing tax credit programs want to see those programs continue to exist. It's not unlike any other political issue. You know, people are there to protect their district and to do what is best for the people that sent them there.
And I think another thing to remember in the whole tax reform and tax credit reform is that, you know, tax credits, as Senator Schaefer said, you know, usually hit a few people, smaller groups of people, not large swaths of Missourians, whereas this tax cut, you know, I would disagree with Kirsten the fact that anybody that's working got a tax cut, period. If you're working, if you have income, you got a tax cut. The highest tax bracket in our state is anybody who makes $9,000 or more. It's a lot of people. So we're not just talking about a tax cut for those who make $250,000 or more or whatever. So I would contend that, yeah, there's still a lot of work to be done in the tax credit reform side of things, and that's something that we can do in the years to come to offset what may come, you know, any sort of budget detriment that may come from this tax cut. But you're talking about one issue that affects a lot of Missourians in cutting taxes, where and then the tax credit, it's a smaller group. And so I think those two things go together. I think we need to continue to work towards tax credit reform in the years to come. And I think that will be an area that we look to help resolve the budget issues.
And again, I'm sorry, Representative Kelly, go ahead.
People don't like tax credits when you call them tax credits. But when you call them the tax credit for domestic violence or the tax credit for the food bank or the tax credit for the wood energy, then they love them. They love them when they're individual programs that they can see and identify the good that they do. The system's got a lot of flaws in it, but individual tax credits have tremendous constituencies. The concept of tax credits, when it is unspecific, has no support. But what happens is when you get right down to the decision-making, those who support the individual tax credits generally triumph.
And I was actually glad this year we were able to separate out what we call the benevolent tax credits from some of the more business-related tax credits, because some of those benevolents, for example, food pantry tax credit and some of the others had sunsets and actually expired. For 3 years I tried to get that reinitiated because that is such a good program, for example, for the food bank here in central Missouri. And it got tied in with the tax credit discussion from a broader perspective. This year we separated out the benevolence, passed those, reauthorized them, and then which was good because if they were tied to the fate of some of the other business-related tax credits, they probably would not have been reinitiated.
Well, it seems like that may have been the death knell this year, right, is that things were tied together. And there's also this kind of imaginary line of what's enough and what's not enough. On mm-hmm. both sides, people are saying this isn't enough. So right. So where is that line that you can tell?
And I think, again, you know, pointing out that we were able to separate the benevolence, it got us a little bit farther down the road in reauthorizing those tax credits, frankly, that everyone agrees on, those that basically have a benefit like the food bank and others. I worked a lot with Senator Lamping from St. Louis, and his concept on tax credits is rather than these package deals on tax credits, why don't we take each tax credit up on its own, evaluate each individual tax credit on its merits, and then, as you said, where is the threshold? But define that threshold on that credit, not because you're going to give X amount to these two other credits, you should give so much to this third credit. And that's a concept that we're really looking at for next year, because the tax credit issue is not going to go away. And the formula that we've been using, which is these large package deals of lumping them all together in one bill, has not worked for the last 4 or 5 years. So the question is, why don't we break them out individually? And I think that that's a good concept, and that's something that I plan on working on.
Well, and the governor did have this Tax Credit Review Commission that kind of did that a few years ago. So is there something wrong with the recommendations
yes.
they've made? Yes,
Representative Kelly. Kurt's idea is exactly correct. See, if you put together a tax credit bill – and it's got 9 tax credits in it, and I don't like 3 of them, but you got the one that helps my district, I'm going to vote for the bill. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. My ashes are being hauled. My people are being taken care of. Then what you do with the rest of it is not my problem. And that's what happens.
And that's what you saw this year.
Exactly right. What you saw. And Kurt's idea makes sense because then you evaluate them each on their own merits. And the other thing about tax credits is people overpromise all the time. You'll hear the people who support, quote, tax credit reform say, well, we could save $600 million. That's the total amount of money that's involved in them. You're never going to get near that. If you got to 200, you would be doing remarkably well. And that's part of the problem is because then you do 200, which would be a huge and productive change. It looks small because somebody promised $600 million.
So what I'm hearing both of you say, or all of you say, is that it really, the comprehensive tax credit reform that a lot of people have talked about that was attempted this year, does that not really ever stand a chance in the state legislature?
I think that we should always look at return on investment on every single tax credit. But trying to do it every year is a giant bill that contains so many tax credits, especially the controversial ones. It's never going to work. And so I think we should arguably have probably overall comprehensive reform, but you have to do it on a tax credit by tax credit basis.
And there's really no way to do that when they're all lumped together because you can look at the merit of each one. But again, like Chris said, you've got three or four that you like and one that you don't like or one or two that you don't like. And that either depending on what your overall view of tax credits are, that either makes you vote for something that you didn't want to vote for, or maybe on the Senate side, it makes you filibuster something that maybe you had something in, you know, and it just provides for a bunch of variables that causes something really to not ever move forward.
But it does get back to the question of, you know, the bill that Caleb mentioned, which was the, you know, the reduction in both corporate and personal income taxes that was sent to the governor, which he'll probably veto. And that is, if we're going to have tax credits, which means we're going to pick and choose what businesses and what industries don't pay the full load of taxes, they get some break. It really does beg the question, why isn't that applicable to all individuals and all businesses? And I'll give you a good example. You know, my Senate district includes all of Boone and all of Cooper County, and I've got Booneville in my district. And Booneville has at least hopefully still a fairly substantial industrial base. They still got Caterpillar and some other good manufacturers over there. But one large employer with several hundred employees was Nordyne. They make heating and cooling equipment, and they just announced they're closing that plant. Well, they do have a newer plant in Tennessee. That's generally where those jobs are going. And you have to ask yourself the question, why are we losing all these jobs in Missouri and they're going to Tennessee? And part of the question, or part of the answer to that question, is the tax climate is better there. It promotes investment in new infrastructure. So they have a newer plant there. They have newer equipment because they're able to do that and get a better tax outcome on that. And also some labor issues as well. But I think the tax aspect is a huge aspect of why we're losing a lot of manufacturing in Missouri. And a good example of that is 2 years ago when we came back in a special session and gave a tax credit, $100 million tax credit to the Ford plant in Kansas City. It's the Clay Como Ford plant. At that time, I know that when I was working with Ford on that, and I had great reservations with that bill. Ultimately, it did go through. But again, we were picking winners and losers. But Ford told me at the time that Clay Como plant in Kansas City had the largest tax liability of any plant, any manufacturing plant that Ford owned in the United States because of both the combination of the local and the state taxes. And so an effort was made in the General Assembly, and the governor asked for it as well, to give them a break from that. But if that's the question, and truly it's a hindrance on Ford to have that tax liability, well, that same liability applies to all manufacturing and all business in the state of Missouri. And so we should reevaluate what is appropriate given the fact that we're competing not only with China and India, as other people like to say, but we're competing with Texas and we're competing with Tennessee and a lot of Indiana, a lot of other states that have reformed their tax structure and a lot of other things that go along with it to create a more inviting environment for capital investment. And we need to do that in the state of Missouri.
I want to take a moment to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking with lawmakers about the state legislative session that just ended on Friday. We're talking about what was and wasn't accomplished this year. Joining me in studio are Democratic State Representative Chris Kelly, Republican State Representative Caleb Broughton, and Republican State Senator Kurt Schaefer. For you and our audience, are there any issues that should have received more attention in the last legislative session? We'd like to know what you think. Share our thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. We'd like to remind you that Intersection is presented as streaming video during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 online at kbia.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at kbia.org. Okay, so moving on to another issue that was came up multiple times this session. Gun control. There was a lot of talk on many different fronts about gun control. One of the bills that's awaiting Governor Nixon's signature is a measure that would nullify all federal gun laws and prevent federal agents from enforcing those laws. So how would that be enforceable if that were to go through? I don't know, Caleb Rowden or Senator Schaefer, if you maybe could talk a little bit about that bill and what its intent was.
Well, I think, you know, you saw, I think there were, on the House side alone, probably 30 or 40 gun bills that addressed the issue in a number of different ways. I think 436 was the number, the one that you were talking about. It got the most attention because it probably reached the farthest. Mm-hmm. We passed it. You know, you can question the constitutionality of it, and I'm not a lawyer, and I may leave that to Kurt. But you know, I think one thing that we have to realize is just the bigger overall conversation that is being had right now. Obviously, the federal government has some desire; they have expressed some desire, led by the president and vice president, to enact some sort of gun control measure, whether it be background checks or bans on high-capacity magazines or some of these other things. You know, I'm of the opinion that, number one, as a state, the Second Amendment is a very popular thing in Missouri. But whether or not, you know, it's probably a 65-35 issue when the state is maybe 50-50 or 55-45 Republican. So, you know, there's no question that the people in Missouri want to know that we are doing what we can to protect the Second Amendment. I think what you're going to see... Obviously, after the Newtown tragedy and Sandy Hook, you know, there was a lot of emotion riding high, a lot of people saying a lot of things, going a lot of different directions. And I think what you're going to see over the next, I don't know how long it is, year or so, I think the conversation is going to die down. Obviously, background checks couldn't even get out of the Senate, which is a democratically led body at the federal level. I don't know that anything substantive is going to come from the federal government. You know, I think a little bit of what we did here was just to make sure that our constituents who are very much pro-Second Amendment knew that we saw what was going on and we were going to make serious steps to ensure that the Second Amendment rights of law-abiding gun owners in Missouri was protected. Did we go about that the right way? You know, maybe, maybe not. I think there's a couple of laws that we passed that are probably a little better, maybe don't go quite as far. But I think that was the intention of our body and the Senate as well, was to say, look, we know what you're seeing. We hear your fears. We know your anxieties. And we're just going to say we're going to do what we can to make sure that you know that your Second Amendment rights are safe. And then we'll move on and we'll talk about jobs or something else.
Representative Kelly, I wonder your thoughts on this. You've talked about the constitutionality of laws like the one we mentioned, but just this whole discussion, this session, I guess your
thoughts. The constitutionality of 436 is not in doubt. It is a matter of absolute lead pipe certainty that it will be declared unconstitutional. There is a 200-year tradition in the United States Supreme Court of finding that states do not have the power to set aside federal law. And that's what it did. It was a direct expression of contempt for the Constitution of the United States. I understand why it was done. It was done for precisely the reasons that Caleb says, to make sure the constituents knew how terribly involved we are in protecting the Second Amendment. I don't think that is license to trample on the Constitution. And no one can make, no prosecutor will allow police in his county to enforce it. No judge will sustain it. It is never, ever going to be law. And to pass it is, I believe, an extremely irresponsible act without regard to what you think about the Second Amendment. The reason the Second Amendment is important is because it's in the Constitution. That's not an excuse to trample on the rest of the document.
What about the focus and the other legislation that came through on gun control this session as well? What are your thoughts on that?
There was some okay legislation. There was some stupid legislation for both sides. See, people on both sides of this tend to turn off their intellectual capacity when it comes to the issue. Sometimes liberals talk about assault weapons when an assault weapon is essentially a characterization of the appearance of the weapon rather than what it will do. And they don't get any further than the term assault weapon. On the other hand, some right-wingers look at any bill that has the word gun in it and think it must be okay. This bill was not supported by the NRA. Now think for a moment what it means when you have gun law that's too crazy for the NRA.
You know, I would have preferred – I had Senate Joint Resolution 14. I would have preferred that to pass. We passed it early on out of the Senate. It went over to the House, and unfortunately, the very last day, the House stuck an amendment on it, which really was not a necessary amendment, and it didn't have time then to come back to the Senate and go through.
What would that have done?
Here's what it would have done. I mean, keep in mind everybody refers to the Second Amendment, which is your right to bear arms under the United States Constitution, but specifically in the Missouri Constitution, it's Article 1, Section 23. That is the equivalent – right to bear arms in the Missouri Constitution, frankly worded a little stronger actually than the United States Second Amendment in the United States Constitution. But basically – and I think the frustration you're seeing, and I think there's a reason for it, a lot of frustration that the government is disregarding the rule of law and picking and choosing what rights to enforce and what rights not to enforce. And I think that the reason you see a lot of Missourians very concerned about this issue is a belief, and I think in some regards rightly so, that the federal government, even though – as the United States Supreme Court calls it, your Second Amendment right is an enshrined right. And an enshrined right is a right like your First Amendment rights, your 14th Amendment due process rights, those rights that are specifically enumerated in the Constitution, as opposed to, for example, a right to drive a car down the road. You know, that is not an enshrined right you have. It's a right within reason and within the realm of due process. But for example, the right to bear arms is an enshrined right both in the Missouri and the U.S. Constitutions, yet there are a lot of people who believe that the federal government as well as state elected officials are disregarding that and choosing to ignore it or at least not give it the weight that it is afforded in those both those documents, the U.S. Constitution and the Missouri Constitution. So what my Senate Joint Resolution 14 would have done, it simply would have added language that says that as an enumerated right, a specifically enshrined right, it is the obligation of elected of the state of Missouri to uphold that right. So in other words, when issues of regulation come down the road and there's a question of whether or not something is constitutional, it's one thing for the state of Missouri to step up and say that they are going to evaluate whatever that regulation is and then make an independent determination of whether or not it is legal, which I think is the appropriate step to take. And then if it's not, to protect the rights of Missourians, as opposed to telling individual Missouri citizens, yeah, we understand that maybe the federal government is implementing a regulation that might be a problem. Good luck with that. Why don't you go spend the $300,000 or $400,000 it's going to take for you to litigate that, and we'll see how it comes out. And so what the language would have done, and it would have gone to a vote of the people in 2014, and it would have given the people of the state of Missouri the ability to say if they want their elected officials to recognize that the rights in Article 1, Section 23, which are your right to bear arms in Missouri, are just as important to your rights of free expression of religion, political speech, your rights to due process, and all those other rights that frankly – everyone acknowledges should be just as important as your right to bear arms.
Right. It's like you said, you like that idea a lot better. But what about this HB 436? Do you think that's counterproductive?
As a lawyer, I mean, the issue that comes down – and so when you get in – having an enshrined right, for example, like that, it dictates the level of legal scrutiny that you get when something comes up. So for example, like your right to drive down the road, you really don't have a constitutional right to do that. And so if there's a regulation that is enacted that affects that, you're going to get what's called rational basis review. And that is there really any reason for the government to regulate this? And in the way they're doing it, is it any way rationally related to the end game? And it's a very, very low threshold for the government to prove as opposed to the highest level of review you get, which is on those enshrined rights, for example, like your right to bear arms, it's strict scrutiny, which means if the government's going to regulate that, there has to be a compelling governmental interest to do it. And the way they go about that regulation has to be narrowly tailored. And so really, it would allow us to use that lens when we evaluate any regulation that comes down the pipe. Because as Chris said, the federal government does have the ability to do some regulation, just as the state does. But the question is does it meet a test of strict scrutiny? Is there a compelling governmental interest? Is it narrowly tailored?
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we're talking with lawmakers about the state legislative session that just ended on Friday. We're talking about what was and wasn't accomplished. I'm Ryan Famuliner. We'll be back right after a short break. Welcome back to Intersection. This is a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuliner. Missouri's legislative session came to a close on Friday. It marked the conclusion of a period that saw a number of accomplishments and some upsets, particularly for Governor Jay Nixon, who this year faced veto-proof majorities in both the House and Senate. On today's Intersection, we're taking a look back at the year and hearing from some lawmakers about what was and wasn't accomplished. Joining me in studio are Democratic State Representative Chris Kelly, Republican State Representative Caleb Browden, and Republican State Senator Kurt Schaefer. We'd like to hear from you and our audience as well. What questions do you have for the lawmakers on our panel? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. And so we were talking about gun control before the break, and Senator Schaefer, since you're here, one of the issues that came up, we mentioned at the top of the show, was the concealed carry permits, the way that those were handled, and ultimately, a list of concealed carry permit holders was provided to the federal government. I would like to hear from you. And also, I guess you'd take some action on that as well, trying to get an investigation. Maybe you talk a little bit and explain what you were doing.
Yeah, that came out of the process. And it actually I started looking into that. I guess it was end of February or so when the Columbia Fee Office changed over. And I got calls from several constituents the very first day the Columbia Fee Office changed over. And they said, we're having to bring these documents in to get a driver's license renewed or a non-driver's license, which is what most people have their concealed carry permit on. Additional documents, mortgage documents, birth certificates, marriage licenses, divorce papers, and those documents were being scanned and kept by the Department of Revenue, which most people recognize was a substantial change of policy and something that alarmed a lot of people. So we brought in the Department of Revenue, and after basically extracting a lot of teeth for a couple weeks, found out that they're essentially implementing a federal law called Real ID, which requires essentially that you build a file on everyone who has a driver's license. It includes a lot of personal documents, which are then subject, frankly, to being compromised if somebody gets into the website for the Department of Revenue or their database. So identity theft is an issue. Also, the concept that as part of this file, there's a high-resolution picture taken of you, and then they take the biometrics of your face, the distance between your ears and your eyes and all those things. And then that's kept – and on a daily basis, it is run against everyone else who applies for a driver's license, as well as apparently some other uses too. And a lot of people, and me included, have an issue with that. It really leads to this issue that we've got technology developing at a very fast pace, especially with the war on terror. A lot of things developed in the Middle East that are now coming back to what is a free society. And really, what are you giving up? What privacy are you giving up just to get a driver's license? And so that debate started. And so the question of, you know, how is the integrity of this information protected led us down a road to find out that, in fact, that the concealed carry list, which at the time was over 160,000 Missourians, now it's over 180,000 just in that short time frame. But that is by law protected in the state of Missouri. It's not to be disclosed. And in fact, the state did produce that entire list to at least one federal agency who was doing arguably some peripheral investigation that really didn't seem very related to that issue to me. But this idea of privacy, collecting information as the Department of Revenue is doing in a way that Missourians really weren't even aware of, because we have a law in the state of Missouri when an agency is going to make a change like this, they have to promulgate a rule and tell the public, and the media picks up on that because it gets posted in the state register. And that was never done to this day, still not done with that process. Mm-hmm. But this idea of gathering more private information on people, really not so much for law enforcement but for intelligence gathering. And it really is a serious question. And I think we were at the forefront of that issue a couple months in the state of Missouri. But now you see what's coming out of Washington, D.C. with the IRS and some other state agent or federal agencies really doing the same thing, kind of taking the next step in private information gathering, almost like intelligence gathering. And it really – it's very troubling. And I think that my biggest concern here is we need to have a public policy debate on the Senate floor, and the governor, who refuses to get engaged in this debate even though he's the one doing it, he needs to very publicly engage in a debate of why he thinks this is appropriate, where the lines are of what is too much, and where we want to go as a state. And we still haven't done that, and I'm not going to be comfortable until we have that debate and decide both as a legislature and as a state of Missouri where we want to go in that regard.
Representative Kelly, I wanted to get your thoughts on this whole scenario.
In 2011, I sponsored a bill to make this information all private. The bill went nowhere. This year, I sponsored the same bill to make all this information private. The bill went nowhere. The reason the bill is not going anywhere is because this is such a fascinating political tool to beat up the governor. if we were serious about the problem, the legislature created the problem by passing laws which allow it to happen. Nothing happened that was illegal. The government had the right to do what it did. I wish the government didn't have the right to do that and have offered legislation to stop it. But the legislature, instead of passing the law to change it, chose instead to yammer on endlessly about how bad Nixon is. If you don't like it, fix the problem that we created. That's why I'm extremely skeptical about the commitment to this whole issue. If you're serious about it, change the law.
Governor Nixon did call this at one point a distraction from other issues. I guess, Senator Schaefer, maybe your thoughts on that.
I don't think it's a distraction at all. I think that the governor's secrecy on this issue and his failure to be engaged or have any public discussion, and then it all comes out, and the public really isn't aware. Really, to get a driver's license, I'm giving up all this personal information, which is now being scanned and kept in some file that, you know, we've seen with, you know, recently a lot of high-profile issues of there is no computer database that is immune from being hacked. People's personal ID and personal information does get stolen. And now this is a new risk for everyone who gets a driver's license, yet the governor refuses to talk about it. Concealed carry list is private and not to be disclosed under state law. The Department of Revenue does not have the ability to scan and keep those documents. And they didn't in the previous law, but we did pass a law this session that specifically says if you didn't understand the law before that says you're not supposed to do this, then we'll pass another one. The problem is, and what we've seen from this governor, is an absolute disregard for rule of law. So I think we could pass 10 laws and the governor's still not going to follow it. So one thing that we did in the process for the Division of Motor Vehicles and Department of Revenue, we said, okay, to this day, we've got to complete the budget. We had to complete it by the week before the session ended, so it was a week ago Friday. You still are not in compliance with the law. You won't even follow the transparent step of promulgating a rule under Chapter 536, which is Missouri's Administrative Procedure Act, to tell the public what you're doing and why you're doing it. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to give you a full 8-month operating budget. And when we come back in January, because we always do a supplemental budget halfway through the fiscal year, which starts July 1st, and we always have to bump some agencies up because they needed more than they told us. What we told Revenue was we will give you more than enough to get past that point. And when we come back in January, if you're complying with the law, we'll give you the last 4 months of the year. Well, we were very clear in our statement on that. The governor said, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to start cutting people in the Department of Revenue, which
layoffs.
Is completely, you know, that's just petulant and it's irresponsible. But, you know, he's the governor. If he wants to do it, he can do it. There's no need to do it, and we certainly articulated a route to avoid that, which is just comply with the law as written. But if the governor doesn't want to do that, there's nothing we can do about that. If he wants to lay people off, that's his prerogative.
So I'm going to move on to another issue just because there's so much to talk about. It's kind of the elephant in the room, something we haven't gotten to yet, but there was a lot of talk about this throughout the session, is Medicaid expansion, the governor's definite attempt to try to do so. And the Republicans also had an idea of how to take advantage of some of that federal money. But I guess why didn't it work this session?
I think it's the cost and the uncertainty. Keep in mind, we got 900,000 Missourians who are currently on Medicaid. And of that 900,000, we spend just over $3 billion of our discretionary general revenue each year on that population. So keep in mind, of the $25 billion state budget, really, the most important part of that budget is roughly one-third, about $7.5 billion, which is discretionary general revenue. All the rest of the money is kind of tied up in other things either as a result of federal or state law. But that $7.5 billion is money that comes in predominantly through income tax. In any given year, we're supposed to have the discretion of where we spend that. Well, just over $3 billion goes to our current Medicaid population, and about $3 billion goes to public education. About $700 million goes to prisons, and you really don't have much left beyond that. What we've seen in the last 4 years, just for that $900,000 person population on Medicaid, our spending on them in the last 4 years has grown by $1.6 billion. About $600 million of that is discretionary general revenue, but the other billion of it is federal pass-through money. But the question is, it keeps getting more and more expensive. What the governor proposed had no reforms at all to curb those increased costs. Now, one thing to keep in mind under the Affordable Care Act and the expansion the governor wanted, that existing population of 900,000 people, that isn't affected by expansion at all. They stay on the same course they're on. Their costs continue to increase as they always have. What we would do, because we would go from 22% of the federal poverty level, which gives us that current 900,000 population, to 138% of the federal poverty level, which would grow the Medicaid rolls in the state of Missouri between 300,000 and 400,000 people. What the federal government said is for just that additional population, not your existing, but that new population between 3 and 400,000, for the first 3 years, we're going to pay 100% of the cost for them. And then after that, it goes down to 90-10, states pay 10, and feds pay 90. Well, on the existing population, we're at a 60-40 match. We pay 40 cents on every dollar. Feds pay 60. And so just the additional 10% cost is a couple hundred million dollars. So only one place that money can come from. And in a college town, it should be very, very important to everyone here. Just as we have seen the existing population take money away from public education, because it's the only pot of money that's big enough, it's why you have seen stagnant growth or no growth in K through 12 and higher ed, because we keep having to increase the amount of funding that we have to pay to stay in the Medicaid program. I'm not ready to expand that, take further money away from K through 12 and higher education, at least until we have the discussion about what reforms are necessary, and the governor had no reforms. We're going to have an interim committee over the summer in the Senate. We're going to continue to look at this and see what reforms we can implement.
Representative Kelly, I'd like to hear what you think.
The failure to expand Medicaid will cost Columbia, Missouri about $45 million because of the increased jobs and the increased growth that would occur as a result of the expansion. That is true not only in Columbia, but I did a study myself on the hospital in West Plains, Missouri. It would mean millions of dollars to West Plains, Missouri, and it will mean money to Truman Hospital in Columbia and to the hospitals in St. Louis and St. Joseph and everywhere else. The fact of the matter is Medicaid expansion would have produced more money into general revenue because of the increase in income tax, not less money. There's no question, and we'd have 3 years where that growth would be, we'd get the entire net of that. After 3 years, we would pick up the 10%. We would never in any year make less in our increased revenue than it would cost us. It will always be better for higher education and elementary and secondary education to do that. Now, it is a convenient Republican talking point to try to pit health care against education, but the fact is the numbers just aren't there to support that. One thing the Republicans are completely correct about is the need for significant reform in the program. And in fact, Caleb has been kind of a leader in the Republican caucus on that front. And I hope some of the things that he's looking at are successful. If we do not do this, the economy of Columbia, Missouri, and other towns that are health-oriented will suffer in an extremely significant way.
Representative Rowden, you both wanted to respond. Representative Rowden,
yeah,
let's give you a chance.
Well, I think the biggest thing to remember in all of this is the same fundamental strategy that proponents of Medicaid expansion use to say, well, we're never going to have to bring funds from education over, is the same strategy that we use when we cut taxes as Republicans. It's a little bit of a little bit of a gamble, if you will, to say, okay, we hope that what we're doing now, whether it be expanding Medicaid or cutting taxes, will infuse the economy, infuse the private sector to the point where there's new dollars, new, you know, revenue growth and everything else. And so there's no way for us to say right now, sitting here in 2013, I've seen the Mizzou study, it operates on a fair amount of assumption because we don't know. We don't have all the facts. We don't know what the federal government's going to do. And I wasn't ever one of the people that said, well, what if the federal government doesn't keep up their end of the bargain and changes the percentage? Well, although that could be a legitimate concern, but even if they don't and we're still on the hook for 10%, that's $200 or $300 million, and there is a chance, and a pretty good chance, I would say, that at some point we're going to take some money from public education to do that. And there's no way that Chris can sit here. I can't say that it won't happen because I don't have all the facts yet because the federal government hasn't given it to us. But there's no way that anybody can sit here in 2013 and say that us expanding Medicaid won't hurt public education in 2020. It's not factual. It's just not.
So what are the implications, though? Because the Affordable Care Act doesn't appear to be going anywhere, right? And so it's going to happen at the federal level at other states. So what are the implications for Missourians if Medicaid expansion doesn't happen?
Well, I think there's a question there because I think it's not moving as rapidly as the federal government wanted. You're seeing a lot of states, just as Missouri did, not buy into it, at least not that quickly. And so I'm curious to see in the next year what does happen. Now, keep in mind the deal that the hospitals cut with the federal government when the Affordable Care Act was enacted, there's what's called the DSH payment. It's the disproportionate share payment. So for the charitable care that hospitals provide, that's the people they treat street who don't have insurance. The Medicaid program reimburses them about 40% on every dollar for that, and about the other 60% comes from basically charging people who do have insurance more on each procedure to cover that. So the deal that was struck with the hospitals at the federal level when they passed the Affordable Care Act was the hospitals agreed to reduction in the DSH payment because arguably everyone would have insurance and the hospitals could then recover that amount and also people would have insurance and they wouldn't have the level of charitable care. What happened was in last summer when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that states did not have to opt in, they had the option to opt out because as the Affordable Care Act is written, it was contemplated that no state could opt out. They'd all have to do it. So when that happened, you suddenly had hospitals put in a position of being in a state that would not do expansion yet potentially also would have a reduction in the DSH payment. So the hospitals really are the ones who drove a lot of this discussion. They're the ones – you know, you look at local chambers of commerce, the state chamber of commerce. Hospitals are always the biggest member of their local chamber, and so they really drove that discussion. And they pushed very, very hard, but it's still – you know, raises the question of the long-term cost and what is the state of Missouri obligating itself to. As Caleb said, you know, the study, even the one that came out of the University of Missouri about all these jobs that were going to be created, I think that's overly optimistic. And I think anybody who objectively looks at that knows that that's not true. It's no different than the studies that went along with the tax cut, as Caleb said, that we passed that showed if you do these tax cuts, you'll have more investment in capital and you'll have a lot of economic activity, which a lot of the Democrats said, oh, that's never going to happen. That's not true. So it's the same concept. Here's my biggest issue with this. To do the expansion in Missouri to go from 22% of the poverty level to 138% is a big jump. Keep in mind, you got states like Illinois and other states, they're already pretty much at 138%. So expansion under the Affordable Care Act, which is the threshold level of 138% the federal law requires, is not that big of a deal for them. But Illinois is paying about 50 cents on every dollar for their entire population. Well, how long before Illinois, when they're paying 50-50 in Missouri under expansion, is only paying 10% until those senators and congresspeople from Illinois step up to the plate and say, we're not going to subsidize Missouri any longer. I suspect that would happen in around 2020 or 2021, and literally that would be over $1 billion. And are we going to commit ourselves to that type of commitment down the road? And I don't think it's appropriate.
So what about, though, the Missourians that will be uninsured will have to start paying penalties based on the fact if Medicaid expansion doesn't go through, what does that mean for them?
Well, keep in mind right now, pretty much anyone who lives in Columbia, for example, you can get everything from dental to chemotherapy at the FQHC, which is over on Worley. I mean, you know, the population generally is covered. It's the question of how you pay for it. People without coverage.
What about more rural areas or something like that?
We have rural health centers, which are the same as the FQHCs. So you've got that care provided. Also, the hospitals do provide that care. And the question is, it's the reimbursement of how they provide that care, but they are providing that care now. You know, where is that threshold? I don't know. I think what we need to find out is with some reasonable reforms like some co-payments and some other things that get some skin in the game for the recipients of those programs. For example, right now, if you have a doctor's appointment and you have insurance, if you make a doctor's appointment and you don't go to your doctor's appointment, what happens? You still get charged. And your insurance pays it, and you have to pay your copay, and you've got some skin in the game, so you don't miss your doctor's appointment. If you have someone who has no skin in the game, they have no monetary engagement at all in that doctor's appointment, they make the doctor's appointment, they don't keep it, the state's going to pay for that doctor's appointment. And so, for example, if you build in some nominal copays and some other things, I think it's appropriate to get people to have some investment in their healthcare decisions. And you're simply not going to have, I think, wise choices on healthcare decisions until you have some skin in the game that it reflects on your own finances.
Representative Kelly, I'd like to hear you respond to some of the things we've talked about here.
Point about the other states wanting to have a fair distribution of the money is an extremely valid concern, and I in fact believe that is the best Republican argument against expansion. I think that's an incredibly valid point. Now, what he said about people get care now. It's true. They get care in the most inefficient way conceivable. They get care in the emergency room. And that ends up going to the bottom line of the hospitals and ultimately to my insurance rates and to yours, the people who are covered. The passage of the legislation, which I believe in the last analysis you will end up seeing all three of us working on because we all believe in reform, and the financial realities are in Columbia's that we're going to have to do something. But what we're going to find is the right package of reform and expansion.
When you mentioned those DSH payments, the federal government has expressed some interest in delaying that. So I guess
About a month ago, we saw the president come out and say that he was calling for a delay in the DSH payment.
Yeah,
and the governor actually came out in opposition to the president. Yeah. Because I think the governor believed that took some leverage off the table because the hospitals were the ones pushing so hard for expansion.
Right.
And I think that he felt that the president, sucked a little wind out of that.
Kind of bought some time, right?
Right.
So then next year, is there any chance of this happening? Are things going to change? Because it doesn't sound like you're going to know for sure.
What does the package look like? I mean, you know, anyone, and I know a lot of people, really lobbied hard and everything else, but this, the concept that the Affordable Care Act, as contemplated by the federal government, was just going to be adopted in the state of Missouri, just as in other states, which are in the same position as Missouri. It wasn't realistic. But is there some mechanism or some way to adopt some reforms and look at expanding the population within reason? I think probably yes. Now, we did pass Ticket to Work this session, which is a provision that does provide coverage for those that it's basically the working poor. So we were able to pass that. So that'll provide some relief for that population. But the question is, how do you provide coverage for those that need it, yet also provide some incentive for wise healthcare decisions?
I want to take a minute to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking with lawmakers about the state legislative session that just ended on Friday. We're talking about what was and wasn't accomplished this year. Joining me in studio are Democratic State Representative Chris Kelly, Republican State Representative Caleb Browden, and Republican State Senator Kurt Schaefer. We'd like to hear from you and our audience as well. Are you satisfied with what was accomplished by lawmakers this year? Is there anything else that should have been done? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. One other thing that didn't happen this legislative session, but it's going to be a big issue going forward, is transportation funds, I-70. There was the 1 cent sales tax that was proposed that didn't happen. I wonder your thoughts on why that didn't happen and what other possible solutions there might be on the horizon.
Well, it made it out of the House. We voted on it, a couple of weeks ago. Made it out of the House with good numbers. You can make the Republican argument that you are voting for the very large tax increase. You're talking about a cent sales tax over a number of years, and it's $8 billion in new revenue. But my pushback to that would be, this is to allow the voters to decide if that's how they want to move ahead in funding infrastructure in Missouri. And so, moved through the House, and there was some opposition on both sides, but there was a lot of support on both sides. It got to the Senate and stalled a little bit. I don't know what – Looking ahead, I think you may see another package next year that's tailored a little bit differently. The dollar figure isn't quite as big. Maybe doesn't go for as long. I think part of the frustration that some had was, $8 billion is a lot of money to give to one group, one state group, and say, here, do what you want with it. And so, there's no doubt infrastructure is a huge part of what we do in Jefferson City, and it's a fundamental obligation of government is infrastructure and roads, and I mean that's what we're designed to do. And so it's not going to go anywhere. I think it'll look different next year, and maybe we'll have a better chance of getting past all the barriers.
I think Caleb's precisely correct. You got to remember, the people who put it together are the highway guys. They're engineers. They see a right way and a wrong way to everything, and they're not very good at compromising. But my experience in the legislature for 18 years is that nothing big happens without compromise. If this is going to happen, we're going to have to see some extremely significant compromise. Maybe we do a more general capital improvements approach. Maybe, as Caleb says, it's shorter or longer. One of the other problems is if you do a 1 cent transportation tax only for transportation, that means the education and mental health people are out of it for the next 15 years, maybe. They're not happy about that. All these things are going, and nothing this big is probably going to happen the first year. Mm-hmm. So this is not at all shocking.
Yeah, and I think, as Caleb said, I think it was the idea of an $8 billion tax increase, which is singly the largest tax increase in Missouri's history in quite a while, if ever, and dedicating that capacity, because you've only got so much capacity that you can use up on sales tax. And as Chris said, you're making a commitment for at least 10 years. If you're going to use that up on highways, you're not devoting that to education or mental health or all the other things that also need improvement. We went very quickly just a year ago from having a discussion, for example, on a $3 billion project to redo Highway 70 with toll roads, which I was involved in several of those public hearings, and the public really didn't like that concept, and so we jumped immediately to all funded by a sales tax. And I think the compromise probably is some combination of a fuel tax and sales tax and a package put together that doesn't eat up all of your capacity for sales tax that may impact other things in the years to come, yet also fund MoDOT sufficiently to redo Highway 70 and some of those other big projects.
We did a poll of constituents on toll roads. People in Springfield wanted a toll on 70 but not on 44. People in Columbia wanted a toll on 44 and not on 70.
That's right.
Yeah. We only have a few minutes left in the show. We've talked about a lot of specific issues, and we want to talk a little bit more general now about the tone of this session and how it went. We mentioned the supermajority, veto-proof majority of Republicans. I wonder, maybe Chris Kelly might be good to start with you, being the Democrat in the room, how that changed the tone of the session and what can these two sides work together in the future?
People think of the veto-proof majority as a monolith, and that's never true. If you look at the two-thirds majority that the Republicans have, it is extremely stable on, for instance, gun questions. But it's not there at all on labor questions, and it's extremely tenuous on tax and education questions. We saw examples of that. This is not – every Republican in the body doesn't think like every other Republican, nor do the Democrats. Yes, for procedural questions, they have a two-thirds majority in both bodies. But that monolith is – you have many, many more shades of difference.
So, yeah, I'd like to get either of your Republicans' thought on that. Was it not as easy as you hoped it
would
be?
Well, I mean, in the House, there's 110 of us in the House, 110 Republicans. And like Chris said, so many variables to go into how we live out our conservatism, if you will, and how we vote and what we're passionate about. And, the geographical – a conservative person from Columbia looks a little different than a conservative from a small town in southern Missouri or whatever. And so all of those variables definitely play into how we work together. There are some issues, guns and life issues and some of those things that we're very – very together on, and others that we're not. I don't know that that's necessarily a bad thing. It's not just a black and white perspective necessarily between left and right, but there's a few shades in there that allow for some meaningful discussions on some of that stuff.
Senator Schaefer, we got about a minute left.
Anything? Yeah, it was interesting. We had new leadership. We elect new leadership every 2 years in the Senate, and Senator Dempsey, our pro tem, and Senator Ron Richard, our floor leader, I thought did a great job. I think that there's always some arguing behind the scenes within the caucus and with the minority party, but I thought that kind of openly our work together was more unifying this year than it has been in the last couple of years, and I think that is owed in large part to their leadership. And I think it was positive. I think it was a very productive session, and I don't think it was nearly as contentious as last year.
Some people say it's better to have a smaller majority because when you have such a huge majority, you tend to develop caucuses within the caucus that war with one another, and I think we saw some of that this time.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we have for today's Intersection. Thanks very much to our guest, Democratic State Representative Chris Kelly, Republican State Representative Caleb Browden, Republican State Senator Kurt Schaefer. And we thank you, all of you in our audience, for joining us as well. We'd like to remind you that if those of you who are enjoying this as a rebroadcast, that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and participate in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is a broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Intersection is produced by Raymond Tungekar, Janet Saidi, Ruben Stern. Tyrus McMillan's our technical director with production assistance from Rachel Gangwer. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. And I'm Ryan Familner. Thanks for joining us today. Have a great week.